Blog Talk Radio.
We know exactly what we should do, and we don't do it. Tonight on Partnerships That Drive Performance, we're exploring this phenomenon. I'm Emily Leibelsberger, here tonight with Mark Gorkin. Hi, Mark. How are you?
Oh, pretty good, Emily.
All right.
Just getting ready for our tete-a-tete.
Yeah, we're going to have a little debate. Mark and I don't quite agree on this. So this phenomenon we're exploring tonight is having the knowledge behind something, behind an action we know we should take. So we've collected all the information. We're equipped with the resources, the knowledge, the material, if there needs to be. And yet we're inactive. We don't act out that knowledge. We don't act. And what do you think is behind that, Mark?
Well, you know, as you're talking, I'm thinking about why. For a long time, people were saying, oh, Mark, you should, be writing another book or putting out another book. You have so much you've written.
Another one. How many books do you have?
Well, about three or four, anyway.
That's great.
Anyway, but, when I'm thinking about it, mm-hmm. why was I putting it off?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I had made an attempt, and I realized it wasn't such a good shot.
Mm-hmm.
It somehow... It didn't make it,
mm-hmm.
and I think that left me a little bit deflated.
The book or the substance of the book?
As it turns out, it was really the structure.
Oh, the structure. Okay. All right.
I tried to make it all things to all people, and I didn't really hone in on a specific target subject area.
All right, so you figured out why, right? You
yes.
Kind of got
and,
so
and
what, then what happened? Did you do
and
it?
And that... Actually, that helped.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing that helped is the stress in my life was reduced.
That always helps. Yeah, but then there's this other thing. People are like, oh, well, when I'm less stressed, then I'll write my book. Or, and how usually, from my experience, life doesn't become less stressful. Does that really happen? You think life just becomes less stressful one
day?
Well,
sometimes... Sometimes it has to get worse before it
That's
has to get
right,
better.
Right,
like,
right.
For example, I had to go through a breakup.
Yeah.
And I think that, I'm sure, kept me away from writing.
Right.
But the process of letting go and reformulating my life, moving, making Columbia, Maryland more my center place, where I was traveling to Cleveland.
Right.
I think those things really... help me get ready to jump in the deep end again.
So where's the book?
The book, in fact,
it's not
on the
yet.
Verge. No, no.
Oh, okay.
On the verge of publishing two books.
All right.
Not just one.
He's really taking action. So Mark Stance, we were talking a little bit before the show on this topic, and Mark Stance, kind of more traditional therapeutic approach, right, is, well, let's figure out why. If knowledge is not leading to action, let's figure out why. What's going on, right? And my stance is a little oppositional.
Of course, she's not quite representing my stance objectively.
For the sake of argument, we'll get to. Can you just not act like a highly trained therapist for 5 minutes? All right. So my stance as an unhighly trained therapist is more: a person can get all the knowledge that they want. If they're so busy acquiring knowledge, researching, they're probably not even ready to act on it. So a lot of times I'm asked, well, why? Why am I this way? Why am I that way? Why aren't I doing this? Who cares? At some point, it's just about action, right? So sure, I understand, and I'm maybe not even fully representing my standpoint right now. I understand there's a reasonable... Let's explore why for a reasonable period of time. But when we get hung up on why, there's no room for action. All right, Mark.
Emily, are you wearing Nikes?
No.
You know the Nike expression?
Just do it.
Yes.
And you'll figure it out as you go along, and you'll make mistakes, and it's okay because they're not really mistakes. They're just learning experiences. And...
Oh, that part I certainly say amen and women to that. I agree.
We agree on that. See, the problem with Mark and I is we really do actually agree more than we disagree. So sometimes it's like we're trying to kind of pick apart, and kind of make arguments more black and white than we really believe they are. Because there really is a lot of truth to why, right? Why does play an important role? But then, Mark, so you were talking about some really good stuff. So there's the why. There's the gaining knowledge.
I agree. Just answering the why from a head point of view.
Right.
You know, just accumulating facts and figures that you can spout off doesn't impress me that much, actually.
Right. So let me dissect this a little bit. So let's say a person goes into, maybe it's therapy, maybe it's just, you know, reading self-help books, and they're really trying to figure out why, right? Why am I a certain way? You know, what's maybe, give me an example, Mark. Like, what might someone present with, and they're looking into why they are what they are? What comes to your mind?
Well, I think of, you know, some people I'm discovering are, you know, really engaged in some destructive, whether it's, be drinking,
right.
It can be sexual craving.
Sure, gambling.
You know,
right.
I mean, those are addictions, and there is a medical component.
Mm-hmm.
But even in those instances, the person knows that they're not either taking a behavior they need to take or stopping a behavior that they
Perfect.
Need to stop.
Perfect. All right, so let's use that example. So, so why am I continuing to walk in this destructive pattern, right? Let's use alcohol, for example. Why am I continuing to walk in this even though I know better? You know, the knowledge is all in support of me giving it up, me maybe, you know, embarking on some other behaviors to kind of help compensate for that. Okay, I understand then that I've got some biological elements to this, you know, whether you call it a disease or not, right, to this thing.
And, of course, one just if I can jump in,
yeah.
One of the most characteristic symptom, if you will, of anyone with any kind of addiction is often, at least in the early stage, denial.
Okay,
so that's
so
that's one of the things. And I probably think a lot of people, you don't have to have such a serious condition as
right,
an addiction
right.
to engage in minimalization or denial.
Sure,
you know,
sure.
We try to downplay the significance of an issue, a problem. We'll
right.
get to it. It's not a big deal. You know, I can always do it if I want to.
I'll go on a diet tomorrow.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Okay, so there's maybe there's denial. But then, okay, let's just say, though, that I'm really bought in. Let's just use dieting to switch from something, you know,
right.
serious.
Well, and that certainly still can be.
So dieting, right? So I know I should diet. I know it's good for me. I get that. I'm gonna go to a therapist, and I want to know a little more about myself, right? So, okay, so I'm bought in. I want to know why. And I get almost obsessed with figuring out myself. We always talk about introspection. Introspection is a very powerful tool. But it can almost become this obsession, like, oh, I found out this about myself, and now I'm this way. You know, I never felt really loved as a child, so when I eat, I feel like I'm filling that void, right? So I'm answering this question of why, and I'm almost obsessing about it, but I don't actually ever go on the diet.
Yeah, because the piece, one piece that's missing
right.
is when you're ready to, when you that craving, that hunger hits.
Yeah.
Instead of trying to figure out why am I feeling, how about just staying with the feeling?
Staying with the
and
feeling.
That's the thing that scares people.
Right, because it's like a heart issue at that point. It's not a head issue. The head wants to figure out why, wants to analyze it, wants to gather information. And then the heart is the part that actually does the crying, the feeling, the emotional release response. That's the part that people don't usually attend to. And what I'm hearing you say is that's where people are stuck between knowledge and acting on that knowledge.
Yeah, but
right.
I think oftentimes the bridge between obsessive knowledge and constructive action is really learning to sit with your emotion and feel it intensely.
So that's why in therapy it's a lot, okay, well, how did that make you feel when you were a child and you didn't get the attention? What happened? How did you feel? And it's sort of like this reliving. That's to help a person then encounter with the heart what they've only really been encountering
but
through the mind.
I really want to support them as much as we're trying to argue. There's one thing about, oh, yeah.
I'm just trying to understand.
Yeah.
And gain our listeners' understanding.
I know.
All right.
there's one thing about saying, yeah, I was really unhappy as a child. That mm-hmm. is not a feeling.
Right. Well, unhappy is a feeling.
But that, but saying I was unhappy. Is
no,
a
it's, how do you feel now? How does that make you feel right now?
Yeah. So the thing that I think we get away from mm-hmm. is just allow, because I think there's a lot of shame.
Yeah.
I'm not going to let them make me feel like I'm inferior
right.
or empty or abandoned.
Right.
Abandonment.
Right.
Oh,
right.
my
right.
God.
Fear of abandonment and protection against them.
You know,
because
it's almost like they've got power over me. I'm not going to let anyone have the power to make me feel terrible. It's all these different voices in our head
right.
that block us
right.
from allowing us to just feel vulnerable, feel really sad to the point where you may be crying, you may feel scared shit.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
that takes courage.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Right. So how do you, as a trained therapist, right, how do you help someone build up that courage to where they can actually face those feelings and do that heart work that then will enable action?
Well, I really want to start by, what are you feeling right now?
Mm-hmm.
And really help them see when they start talking and then shift topic,
mm-hmm.
did you see what just happened?
Yeah.
It was so hard to just stay with that feeling.
Right. Yeah.
And I wonder if that happens, you know, every minute of the day practically.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so that's, so you want to get to, first get the person to be able to just sit with that feeling.
Mm-hmm.
I think I once talked how a nurse told me how she quit cigarette smoking. She challenged herself when that urge to smoke that cigarette came up, she would make a bargain with herself, so a deal. You wait 5 to 10 minutes.
Hmm.
If the urge doesn't pass, you have that cigarette.
Mm-hmm.
But before you can have that cigarette, you've got to sit with that anxious, you know, wrenching feeling
it.
For 5 to 10
right,
minutes.
Right, feel it.
And that, she said, is ultimately what helped me stop smoking.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. You know, in coaching, I do a lot more of the action response, and, you know, it's not quite just do it, you know, to be clear, right? So I do this feeling work to a degree. I would say the difference is that I you know, it's not within my capacity professionally, and I'm not licensed. So I really shouldn't stay with a person on this. But then I really shouldn't ignore that either.
And
right?
you don't.
So we refer,
I think you, one way you approach it as
right.
a coach is through communication.
It's exactly through communication, kind of what message are you sending to yourself, what message are you sending to others. It's through communication. Introspection, right? So I promote the message to yourself, right? Knowing what message you are saying to yourself at any given moment. And that a lot of times will lead, though, to a client becoming much more aware of themselves, aware of their thought processes, and they want to know then why. And a lot of times they're really excited to go to counseling because they want to really figure themselves out on that level. And sometimes, you know, if the coach and the client and the therapist are in agreement, we can continue coaching if it's appropriate. And sometimes we'll pause coaching, right? Because sometimes there just needs to be that space to figure ourselves out and not worry about action. And then we can come back to the active component. So.
You know, that's very important and almost becoming a dangerous, you know, potentially extinct species with all this, you know, digital.
Oh, introspection?
Introspection.
Right.
You know, just being disconnected, allowing yourself to have some solitude.
Right.
Some really quiet, non-connected time.
Right.
To plug into your own computer.
Right.
Your mind.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. Like the old-fashioned computer.
That's exactly
brain.
Right.
All right. So, Mark, let's talk a little bit about tangibly, you know, what you and I do. So I've been asked by a lot of our listeners, you know, well, what do you and Mark really do? So let me talk a little bit about that. So Mark is, we have a three identities, really. So we have Mark Gorkin, the stress doc, and his identity. We'll talk about that in a little while. We have Emily Leibelsberger, the communication strategist, and her identity. And then we have Mark Gorkin and Emily Leibelsberger together in collaborative form and our identity, which in part is this show.
Reality Radio.
Reality Radio, yeah.
Which I think is, you know, it's interesting that you and I both came up with that expression sort of independently and shared it with each other because we sensed, hey, what we're doing on this radio show, especially in the last couple of weeks of trying to stir things up.
Yeah.
You and Joel, her husband, you know, you and your husband had a kind of a serious discussion about a real life issue.
Yeah.
You know, in the beginning of the show, you interviewed me as I talked about some, you know, very poignant areas that I'm grappling with now, feeling vulnerable about in terms of finances, relationship, and then an unfinished conversation with my dad who's deceased. So I think, you know, I think what we're
and I'm
both
on the couch tonight.
Yeah, so yeah, I think later. What we're both excited about is seeing when two experts are willing to sort of, and a friend of mine who heard the show, you know, said, boy, you guys are taking risks.
Yeah.
You know, and I think there's something very exciting about it. And it feels less scary, though Emily is always able to get me a little bit on edge. You know, tonight she wanted me to be a little more, you know, combative when we had, you know,
I got to put him through some combative training.
Yeah.
He's all highly trained in, you know, objectivity and all that therapy stuff. He's too good at it.
But he's a big crybaby at heart, and it comes through. Anyway.
But I want you to make me cry, you know? Like, you got to be argumentative and debatable and, you know, make me...
No, actually, I think with you, Emily, the more combative I are, the more you like that.
in radio personality form, correct. Yeah, you know, I incite the conflict.
No.
That's my role. But...
And in fact, it's a great strength in that you're not afraid to really roll up the sleeves with someone.
Right.
Let's get real. Right. You're not gonna puncture me. You're not gonna wound me.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. So collaboratively, we have this radio identity, this reality radio. If that's not trademarked already, don't trademark it, please. Wait for us. So this whole idea that we're taking risks, we're playing things out, and at least my goal in it is to sort of bring risk-taking, healthy risk-taking, because, you know, the world engages in a lot of unhealthy risk-taking as it is. So this is about healthy, productive risk-taking, and bringing that into people's lives and relationships, and at work as well as at home, asking questions, being more curious about each other, so that ultimately... we can put us out of business. You know, we won't need any coaches or therapists. But no, we're a ways away from that. Our technology-driven world. We really don't engage enough on a curious level about each other. So I want to promote more of that. That mutual curiosity and respect building. That's really my goal for the show.
Yeah. No. In fact, I think there's another difference between us, and it's not black and white.
Oh man,
I know you
excited.
Want it to be.
Yeah,
but I think just in a way, Emily has divided results-oriented communication.
Communication is only as effective as its results.
There you go. And my latest speaking program is titled "Leading with Passion, Power, Inspiring Through Clarity." Through courage, clarity, and creativity.
Now, I got to point something out. We got three C's. We got two P's. Mark is very much a letters, you know, very inspirational.
He's the
right?
pioneer of this new AA, 12-step AA group, Acronyms Anonymous.
Absolutely.
So,
yeah, and that's, you know, there's a difference is that when we align and use those differences together, really promotes a very effective, positive product. So let's talk about, we'll get back to some of that in a little bit. I think it's time for Who's on the Couch.
Oh, okay.
So I'm on the couch today, and since the topic is exploring what's between knowledge and action, I've chosen the topic that, you know, really kind of, I want to explore and figure out a little bit about what's going on and maybe, I guess, cry and have some heart time. No, I don't know. You never know. Mark is a therapist. He'll probably make me cry. But it's really a topic that's really close to me, which is I understand for my physical fitness and as well as just my emotional well-being, I feel really good when I walk independently, but I don't do it. And I understand the benefits of it. I've experienced the benefits of independent walking, just to walk, not to go somewhere, but, you know, I just don't do it.
Emily?
Yeah.
Let me just ask a clarifying question.
All right.
What makes walking independently a challenge for you?
I mean, you know, walking independently is a challenge for two reasons. So, being visually impaired, right?
Okay, that's...
I don't, you know, there's two dimensions of it. On one hand, I'm by myself, so there's the, you know, getting lost factor, which some blind people, including myself, really enjoy sometimes. Sometimes it's really fun to get lost and have no idea where I am. But embracing that, getting into that moment where I'm willing to take that risk, doesn't always happen for me, even though I've experienced the benefits of it. So there's one dimension of getting lost. The other dimension that makes it challenging as a blind person is just being alone, even though it's really good for me and I'm able to do it in other areas of my life. I'm not really used to walking, moving, mobile, alone time. I don't drive, so I don't have that in the car decompression time that you might have on your commute. You may hate it some days, but it's really a blessing. I don't have a lot of alone time outside of my house.
You know, I'm wondering, well, let's envision you walking by yourself at a mall.
Yeah.
What do you conjure up?
Well, these people, like, look at me, you know? It's like, ooh, there's a blind lady, and she's got a cane. I've never seen this before, and it's some spectacle. It's like this new thing. I don't want to be a new thing. I just want to go for a walk. You know, I laugh, but it's true. I just want to be by myself. You know, you can just go for a walk, and no one looks at you. They don't think twice to look at you. You're just like everyone else. I just want to blend in like everyone else.
And yet, I think one of the challenges of most people with a disability, especially a visible disability, is that you can't totally blend in.
Yeah, fine, but that doesn't take away the feeling of wanting to blend in.
Okay.
Sometimes I don't want to blend in. Sometimes I want to be the center of attention.
So what,
but when I'm going for a walk, I want to blend in.
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course you would want to blend in.
Yeah.
So what's the feeling knowing that in that kind of situation, you can't blend in?
It's frustrating. I feel unequal. I feel disadvantaged. I feel angry at that disadvantage.
What I also sometimes think is that there's a feeling underneath anger that we don't allow ourselves to get to.
Well, I'm grieving that, yes. Or, you know, that it's weird to grieve something that I've never had, right? The ability to really blend in. But I think I do grieve that. It's just loss, I guess. I can't think of it as grieving because it's just weird to grieve when you're around. It's loss of it.
I think it's very much related to grieving. You know, it's a it's a certain freedom and autonomy that people take for granted that, you know, you can't.
Right.
And you know, I think there's a sadness, and that it doesn't mean that. You see, I have a saying that I think is appropriate, not just for you, Emily, mm-hmm. but for a lot of us mm-hmm. who make it hard to allow ourselves to grieve. And that is, there's a real difference between feeling sorry for yourself and feeling your sorrow.
Yeah.
When you're feeling sorry for yourself, you're usually blaming others.
Mm-hmm.
When you're feeling your sorrow, you're having the courage to face your pain. And we all need time to feel our sorrow.
I think what frustrates me is when I'm, like, feeling my sorrow, you know, and I get that. I think that's really healthy. And when I want to talk to someone about it, they're like, oh, what really gets to me is they're like, oh, well, oh, yeah. So is it true that, like, even though you can't see, you can, like, hear better? Like, your other senses compensate for your visual loss?
Yeah.
It just makes me so mad
because, you know,
they're not getting it. They're not feeling it with me. I just want to be validated in my sorrow.
Of course.
I just want to be like, hey, I get it.
And
that
why
sucks.
Why can't they stay with you?
Because it makes them uncomfortable.
Exactly. Exactly. And not just your blindness that makes them uncomfortable. It's the loss that you're talking about and the loss that they don't want to deal with in their own lives.
Yeah.
Because we all, who is it? Judith Viorst wrote a great book called Necessary Losses, how losses are part of the human experience constantly throughout life. And when we don't really face them and grieve them, they come back to bite us.
All right, so I get this, though. So I'm still not going to go walking tomorrow.
Okay.
I mean, I don't know. I guess, you know, at some point.
Of course, there's a difference. I put you in a very difficult situation, the mall.
Right, yeah, you did.
Where if you walk.
Everyone's looking at me.
Yeah, if you walk down your street, which is a pretty quiet street.
Okay, my street, yeah. So I live on a cul-de-sac, and if I walk down my street, and this is the part that's a little irrational, right? So I walk down my street, and suddenly, you know, everyone at that moment is looking out their window to look at the blind lady.
They have nothing
the
better to do in
they
their
have
lives.
But they did a minute ago, but now that I'm out there, they're all staring at me. I was with a friend of mine one time. He's blind, too. And we were walking. It was like the first time. I hadn't really walked. I've got little kids, so I just don't have a lot of opportunities to walk alone anyway. And so we were walking by ourselves. And so the way blind people walk and learn is by making mistakes. And, oh, I just ran into that sign. I'll remember that's there the next time. And then I remember that that sign indicates that there's a street right there. And so we formulate a view, a map, if you will, based on trial and error. So we're walking. We ended up walking to the elementary school, walking on our way back home and getting very lost in the process. And the whole time my friend's like, oh, you know, there's someone. We can ask them for directions. I'm like, no, keep walking. Don't stop, you know. And it's this whole idea of them. I didn't want to ask them a question because what are they going to tell me? You know, some visual landmark about where we are, or you know. But more than that, I didn't want to feel like to know that they're looking at us. And then we came across these people playing ball, and I'm like, turn around. And he's like, what? I'm like, it's those stupid ball people again. They're playing a game. We've already walked past them. I don't want them to see us again. They'll think we're lost. He's like, well, we are lost. You know, and so there's this thing that I'm having a really hard time getting over of who cares what
let's,
they think.
Let's call it wounded pride and ego.
Wounded pride and ego. Okay. All right, I'll play with that.
Okay, because I think that's a big part.
Now, what's weird, though, is I don't care that I'm talking about it and, you know, the whole world is listening because our show is really popular. That doesn't bother me.
Yeah, because it's one, you're inside.
Yeah.
Two,
and they can't see me.
Yeah, the only person that can see you, is me right now.
Not for long. I'm about to leave the room. I'm kidding.
No.
I don't care because you know me.
Right,
I don't care when people see me who know me. It's when strangers look in and they're like, oh, she must be lost. But then they don't even ask me. It's like they're just thinking about it. And then they're like, they'll talk to their friends and be like, I saw this blind woman. I think she was lost. Well, I didn't talk to her. I wouldn't want to be rude. Well, maybe you're being rude. Just looking at me and thinking I'm lost and not even addressing me. Maybe that's rude, you know?
You know, I think...
I love people, I really do.
I know. And I think what's important is that you're allowing some of your real frustration and anger...
Oh, yeah.
Come, you know...
Count on me.
Come out.
Right.
And I think we don't do that enough.
Right.
So that... Because I don't believe Emily typically thinks people are rude.
No, I really don't.
Just this subject
stirs that up.
A lot of emotion.
Oh my goodness.
Of frustration,
yeah.
A lot of that feeling of why do I have to be so different and noticeable?
Right.
You know, that. So when we're kind of worked up about something, our anger is going to come out in all different directions. And that's natural and normal, but we want to learn from it.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of, really the key.
By the way, for anyone listening, the biggest way you can help a blind person, offer to go buy them takeout. It sounds really weird, but seriously, I don't get takeout enough because I can't get in the car and go buy it with nobody looking, right? There's always someone's permission, whether they feel like they're giving me permission or not. I always have to ask someone's permission. Hey, can we stop here and get this? I don't get to have my secret guilty pleasure takeout food. So, you know, that's kind of funny, but really it's very serious. These things that we don't, as blind people, don't get to secretly indulge in. I feel like everything is public. Sometimes things I don't want to be public. I'm all good telling you all my insecurities and deep dark secrets. I don't mind. But if I want a burger, I don't want you to know about it. How's that for the couch?
Well, I think you've captured a lot of complexity. And
come on, stress doc, shrink me.
Well, you know, I'm going to see. I see two sides.
Yeah.
The part of you that doesn't want to have to stop and ask for help and doesn't want, you know, these people to have seen us the second time because they'll think we're lost, you know, that
which we are.
That shows our weakness.
Right.
And yet, this is the woman that also very strongly and knowledgeably and wisely talks about interdependence.
Right.
So you have these sort of warring sides to you.
But hold on a second. I don't just talk about it.
No.
I engage it as well.
Oh, you do.
And this is the thing. It's like my little issue. Because I guess this is how maybe I rationalize it. Or we all have our issues, right, where we're less likely or less willing. And then we have our issues where we're our dimensions where we're more willing. I guess what I'm getting at isn't so much the identification of the issue. It's more... what happens in me? What do I need to do to get to that place where, screw it, I don't care what they think. I don't mind asking for help walking. Because I've been there. I've been there a lot of time. I'm not there right now.
Yeah, I think that's, and you know, I don't think you can, as I think they say in 12 steps, you can't think yourself into taking action.
Right.
That is, you can figure out this and that. I think at some point, as you said, there is some truth to, I've got to just do it and become more aware of all the anxiety that gets stirred up in me as I'm walking.
So I think he just gave my approach some credit there, the just
yes.
do it approach, right? So,
yes.
So, but it's combining, and I agree with you, it's just combining my just do it approach with the feelings, which are also part of my approach, feeling it as I'm doing it kind of approach.
Yeah.
And more importantly, I would add to that, I think what I need to do, when it's really the issue at hand, because I mean, I chose that tonight, but it's not like this issue is plaguing me. When this issue is plaguing me in the springtime, really, when it gets nice, because right now it's cold, so I don't want to go out anyway. But, you know, when the weather gets nicer, I will get to that. It's going to be important enough, valuable enough. Right now it's not valuable enough. I don't think that I'm ready to put my logic into practice because it's just the stakes aren't high enough. I'm not giving up enough by not doing it right now. So when the weather gets nicer and there's places to go and, you know, people are outside and, you know, interactive, it gives me a little more incentive. So So I'm going to be more willing to take those risks and go out and intentionally, because I have done this before, I do practice what I preach here, intentionally ask someone for directions or for help or whatever. I think that's it for me, is just when it becomes imperative that I do that right now. It's not really. I've got other
things. No, that certainly makes sense.
Yeah.
And because, it's my final 2 cents on this. It sounds like the more that you can figure out what you want to do, do it, and not be so preoccupied how others are viewing you.
Right.
I think that's where the greater freedom will come.
And I've experienced that before. You know, I've definitely experienced that at times in my life. College especially, you know, I didn't care as much at all. Early college years, I was unattached. I didn't care what people thought of me. I think motherhood makes that, you know, a little, you know, because everyone's kind of, I don't know, motherhood's interesting, you know. But I think I've had a lot more time to myself for introspection, which is great. And sometimes introspection, I can overthink things, you know. And I think I'm very much an extrovert. I'm very much a people person. And while I appreciate time to myself, sometimes I get too much of it, and I get too comfortable and complacent, and I'm good with that. I'm comfortable.
Let me just ask something.
Yeah.
Emily, did you sense any feeling as you were talking, any sort of kind of an emotional response?
I always sense feelings.
Yeah, because I sensed it in your eyes a little bit.
Yeah. Well, I think there's not a time when I'm talking that I don't feel. You know, I'm always...
But I'm talking about a certain poignant feeling.
I don't know. Let me think.
Okay. I just I thought I saw a little watery sense.
Oh, no. I honestly didn't.
Okay.
No, unfortunately.
Okay.
Something to keep in mind, too, and I don't know if you've worked with blind people, but for me anyway, I don't think there's always a correlation between visual response and, you know what I mean? You know, like some people, you can kind of read their visual.
Right.
And it'll give you a pretty accurate.
Okay.
For me, I read people's inflection.
Very well.
Right. And for me, I notice that inflection kind of gives people away even more than a visual might, because people are usually pretty guarded with their visuals, and they might know how to manipulate them. I just don't respond. I don't think I respond visually all the time. I kind of keep that.
Okay.
I don't know. Maybe intentionally. I don't know.
Well, if for someone doesn't want to, certain people or many people to see her, I would think you would.
But I'm thinking about what you said, and I don't think that there was, but I'm kind of curious now. Like maybe you saw something that I didn't even feel, or that I didn't know that I felt.
Okay.
I don't know.
I just sort of.
I'll get back to you on that.
Do
you know when it was? When was it? What were you talking about?
You know, when we were talking about loss, and you were talking about that loss of autonomy and not being able to take for granted what so many others can do.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there was definitely like a moment, you know, I did kind of flash back to like, you know, when I was 16 and everyone's getting their license. This is really hard for me because, you know, they're all driving and getting all this independence. And I'm just supposed to be independent without that symbol and ability to go anywhere, you know. These kids, and I still feel scared to death, 16-year-olds behind the wheel, but I bet I'm not alone in that.
You know, I wanted to share something that just popped up.
Yeah.
My father tried to teach me to ride a bike
when
I was, I guess, you know, 6 or 7 or whatever. And he probably bought a bike that was too big. I couldn't learn, and he was a type A, impatient.
So like failure.
Failure.
Yeah.
And I didn't learn. You know how I wound up finally learning to ride a bike when I was about 11 or 12? I basically said, give me that little bike. You know, some 6-year-old had a small bike.
Right.
And I spent, you know, a few hours
mastering
teaching
it.
My,
yeah.
But I never had the independence of riding those racer bikes that so many of my friends rode. And,
right.
You know, it was like, and there's always a sadness when I think of that story.
Well, you know, I think one thing that maybe would have helped, that if I ever parented a blind child, we've talked about adopting, and if I ever parented a blind child, you know, I think one thing I would do a little differently than my parents did is, you know, I would live in an area of walkability. We, not only did I not drive, but we lived on a main road and there were no sidewalks. And it was a very, it was like the opposite of walkable for a blind person. So I couldn't go anywhere, even if I wanted to. And I think that, you know, where I live now, it's a lot more walkable. But now I'm, for the first time, kind of like, well, not the first time, first time since college, I guess, kind of independence is a potential possibility. Although when I was working outside the home and when I go on business trips, I'm very independent. And people, you know, people in airports, you know, last year I went on a couple of business trips last year for work and doing coaching and facilitating, and I didn't care what people thought about me because I was purpose-driven. It was worth it at that point. And I think that's, but if I get into my own thoughts to a point where I stagnate, I'm focusing on the negatives. And
you know what,
I
wonder if, I don't know if this is...
I'm verbally processing, I'm jumping around all over.
No, it's because I'm just focusing on, you know, when you're working and you're feeling good about yourself.
Right, because it's productive, so I really don't
care. Who cares
what
people
think?
So that's the key, is that often when we're not,
right.
Like I know I went through a period a couple of years ago when work was, you know, really slow. And,
right. Well, even working
from
home.
It's hard.
Yeah.
It's one of the reasons I write as much as I do, because I always have said that I feel I need to justify myself least when I'm writing.
Yeah.
By that I mean writing is always a challenge and difficult, and if I'm jumping... See, risk-taking can certainly be risk-taking with other people.
Right.
But it also can be risk-taking in terms of your own,
You
know, creative... products or your own personal challenges for yourself.
Right.
And so that sort of helps keep me sane writing when I'm not feeling real good about some of the other facets of my life.
Well, I think that's where the show, you know, for me, I'm so willing and I want more risk because that's engaging to me. I writing is great, but it's too introspective. It's too quiet. I want more noise. I work from home right now, so there is not enough of that component. Even though I work with people, there's still just not quite enough for me sometimes, enough like interaction and you know, unpredictable engagement.
You know, I just read a book called The Call of Solitude.
Which is why I have to go outside and get lost.
Yeah, okay, I'm sorry. Yeah.
No, okay.
I'm sorry to jump in. But I think what we're talking about really does transcend you and me and really applies to a lot of people out there. As I was saying, this book that I read just recently, The Call of Solitude, and she really talks about, or part of it, is how so many of us have had to stuff down something that was part of our essence because we have to support a family, we have to, you know, a 9-to-5 job, you know, but that calling, that need doesn't go away, and that somehow we do need to find the time and space, you know, if whether it's a hobby, whether it's, you know.
Let me elaborate on that.
Yes,
I think,
please.
You know, we're talking about why don't people act, right, on their knowledge.
Yeah.
Well, I know I need to do this, you know, it makes sense, but I'm resistant. I think speaking out our resistance and sometimes and just processing through it with other people or not, but that's part of the heart issue that you're talking about. So the resistance in this case that you're talking about is that calling, that hobby maybe, that thing that you don't want to have to feel like you're giving up by a 9-to-5, right? So, and you talked last time about not doing that, about not taking the 9-to-5 on a regular basis, like maybe there were some pressures to do for the sake of your creativity, right? You wanted to really keep that creativity engaged.
And also knowing that I have a depressed nature, and
right.
I'm not as good as just sucking it up.
Sure.
You know, I don't necessarily think it's just my creativity. It's a realization that I can't just, you know, kind of
exist in that form.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. And I think that that's part of it is what is our resistance, right? And a lot of people are like, well, I don't know. Okay, well, if you did know, what would it be? Right? And so it's amazing what kind of answers people come up with. So, you know, I think that adds a dimension. So it's exploring with the head, right? Why? Then it's responding to that with our heart and feeling those feelings. And then I think it's sharing where we're coming from, our perspectives. Well, if I do this that I know I should do, then I'm going to have to compromise this or give up this. Well, what's our resistance? Right? So then it's processing that on a heart level as well, feelings that go along with that.
Yeah, no, I dropped out of a doctoral program because I wasn't mature enough to really focus on a realistic dissertation topic.
Right.
And at the same time, I had an experience, you know, that really told me, this is where you want to be digging.
Yeah.
Inside yourself and figuring out and expressing your emotion, your
right.
ideas, your
right.
developing your own language.
Yeah.
But not everyone is in a place where they can be so, you know, we talked about egocentric. I was very egocentric. I was, you know,
okay,
driven
for our
by.
Listener, what does that mean?
I was driven by developing my
own self,
talent, skills,
yeah, yeah.
sense of what's called individuation, my unique wholeness.
It's all about me.
And it can be a very selfish thing.
Mm-hmm.
It also probably is what, you know, true artists, you know, feel compelled to do.
Yeah.
You know, it's not so much, as I tell people, you know, it was less of a choice. This is what I just had to do. And not everybody's in that place. So how do you find, like my father finally did, you know, and it took 12 years of group therapy and doing a lot of other things, but he discovered that he loved tennis. And he, you know, the last 10 years of his life was working, but he made time for tennis.
Mm.
You know, and I don't know how we do that exactly.
Make time for how we do what?
Yeah, how do we make time for what's, you know, what's the bread and butter and what's our soul?
Well, I think that's really interesting because a lot of times when I talk about introspection with people, they're really on board. Yep, I know it's important. But isn't it selfish? And I'm sure you've gotten that before too,
sure.
right? Isn't it selfish for me to be focusing on myself like that? Can you just talk about maybe that boundary of when it's productively, when it's productive and when it's selfish and kind of a little negative.
You know, I'm going to go back to my father. Because
mm-hmm.
when he wasn't doing that,
yeah.
when he was depressed and not getting therapy and sort of, you know, avoiding us and maybe drinking a little bit more
mm-hmm.
and maybe, you know, acting out in different ways, he wasn't there.
Right.
When he was playing tennis, when he was present, he was much more alive. He was much
right.
more vibrant. He had much more good energy
right.
to share.
So even though he took time out for himself, he was more present for you when he was home. And when he wasn't taking that self time, he wasn't present anyway. So that was actually more selfish of him because he was denying you and your family that...
And himself,
that presence, that experience. So in other words, right, it's a risk mitigation thing, right? So all right, well, I'm going to be taking this time and being introspective for my personal growth. But as a result, I'm going to be present for my family when I am home. It's like work when you're working and be home when you're at home, right? There's this mother debate, right? Do I work? Do I stay home with my kid, right? And for me, I work and I'm also with my kids. And I try very hard to be at work fully when I'm at work and then to be at home fully when I'm at home. Now, as a stay-at-home, working at home mom, that gets a little gray at times, but that's my goal. It's that whole idea of setting boundaries around self-introspection time and for the sake of being fully present when we're with other people.
And, you know, sometimes it does take a village.
It does, right, so talk about that.
That, for example, you have a good friend living with you guys.
Right,
and who's able to give a little bit of a hand at times.
Yeah, right, and I think even people who don't have someone living with them, it's okay to, you know, I always say we don't need to have people over for dinner. We should have people over. You know, I don't know that our society knows how to do that all the time. It's like there doesn't have to be a big production. It's just about doing life together and being in a moment with people, sharing the day with them, you know.
And, of course, it speaks to the value of the grandparent relationships.
Absolutely.
You know,
yeah.
when families are blessed to have that, you know, opportunity where, you know, I'm thinking of friends in Cleveland who are able to leave their, you know, little fella with you know, my friends,
mm-hmm.
the grandparents,
mm-hmm.
and how, you know, it just allows the two to continue working. And,
right.
You know, so.
Yeah.
So it's because it really does take a village to raise
yeah.
a kid these days. And we need
not
to,
a Facebook village either. It's not going to do
yeah,
that.
Right.
Like a real people.
Yeah, no.
All right, Mark, we got a couple of minutes left.
Yeah, we've thought about
that.
Well, let's think about, do you have any other thoughts or closing thoughts about our time on the couch?
I guess, you know, my only closing thought is that I struggle when I'm maybe understimulated. And
that certainly is a big issue for us. We should
right.
talk about that sometime.
Right.
The epidemic of if I'm not stimulated, what happens?
Right. And then I think the other thought I had is, you know, when I do coaching sessions, I always ask clients, what do I let them usually vent for a little bit. I give them a couple minutes of, hey, what's going on time, right? And they vent. Sometimes what they vent about isn't even what they want to work on, which is something I learned very early on. And so I'll stop them after maybe 3 minutes or so. And what do you want to get out of this session today? And the reason I bring that up is that I did the walking topic because it was an area I could think of that directly related to the disconnect intellectually with understanding something and not putting it into practice. But it's not actually something I really care about right now. And so what I got out of today was I will care about it. I will do it when it's something I care about again. And it's important because, you know, what other people want for us to care about, we might not care about right now. You know, other people would like, I know my husband would like to see me walking, you know, not because I'm out of shape, but he knows it's good for me. And that's great, and I can appreciate it, but right now that's not something, you know, that I'm motivated to focus on. My focus is in other areas, mostly professionally, right now, and that's it's invigorating in and of
You know
itself.
What, just to be contrary,
yeah.
I don't think walking is so much about physical exercise for you. I mean, it is a little bit, but I think it's, and this I think is important, is that it's putting you out there as you're showing off your disability.
Yeah, it's not really painting me in the best light.
In your mind,
right.
It isn't.
Right.
And that's the issue,
Even in someone else's mind, though, because I don't want to be, even though they might think it's amazing that I walk. And
no,
walk,
it's not.
Even what I want to be known for.
Except that's still in your head.
But that's what matters, is my head.
Well, but that's the part that I think you still want to work on.
Well,
that
if
is,
I decide to work on it. Then
that's, or from my point of view, would be worth working on.
Yeah,
your decision.
Sure.
And
right.
That is, why am I still so as concerned as I am about how other people view me, judge me, perceive me, label me? How do I get more?
I think it's a little oversimplified, but I get where you're going. I think that, you know, because I wouldn't necessarily say, and those that know me,
but you know, as you were telling the story, Emily, you really got emotional when you talked about, I don't want them seeing, you know, I don't want to go to walk the same way. I don't want them seeing us twice and they're thinking we're lost. And,
I don't.
Okay, so what I'm saying.
But that doesn't mean that I overall, like, care about what people think of me and all that. Like, I don't think
you care so much about what they think about your specific skills and talents.
I do. Maybe it's that since they only see me in that, in my opinion, not as positive light, I wouldn't care so much. See, when I'm working, this is the revelation I'm having.
Okay, good.
When I'm working, I don't care. Because they're seeing me for what I can do, as well as my perception that they're seeing me for maybe what I can't. They kind of like that one that I can way trumps the other. So it's, I have a way in which I can balance out the equation, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, yeah. No.
But then, like, when I'm just walking and they just have this fleeting encounter, even if I talk to them, I'm fine. It's when I don't talk to them, which means that, you know, talking to them and engaging with them is probably something I should be doing more often, and it might make it a more enjoyable experience for me. Because it's when I don't talk to them that I'm in my head about what they're thinking.
Okay, so that's a good, that's a good takeaway.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
You know what? I have a feeling, just as some of my issues are going to keep coming up on the couch.
Yeah, that one can come back up on
the
couch.
Yeah, I think we've cut it a little too close for me to read my poem tonight.
Because I ramble on.
Well, but you know what?
That's what happens to me when I'm in counseling.
You know, and that's what reality TV is. It's not so scripted.
You mean reality radio.
Reality radio, thank you.
Yeah.
We can't predict exactly where it's going to, you know, meander.
That's it. Absolutely.
And,
We love your thoughts about how tonight's show went. I'd love to hear your comments. Check us out on Facebook, on the Blog Talk Radio site. You can leave comments there, I'm told. And we'd also love to hear your suggestions for future shows. What should the Stress Doc and the Communication Strategist explore next week on Partners for Performance? Check in with us and let us know your thoughts. Have a good evening.
Good night.